now in the case of bonds against the United States. Mr. Wyman.
Your Honor. May it please the Court. The District Court's order denying Mr. Bonds' habeas petition should be reversed, and this case remanded, because the District Court legally erred in both aspects of its ineffective assistance of counsel analysis. The first error is undisputed. In rejecting Mr. Bonds' contention that his counsel should have raised a Kimbrough argument at sentencing, the District Court relied on U.S. v. Welton for the proposition that Kimbrough has no effect on sentences imposed under the career offender guidelines.
I need some help from you because Bonds raised only a Kimbrough argument for a shorter sentence in the Section 2255 motion. How is that sufficient to preserve an argument based on Section 4A1.3, that the criminal history category substantially overrepresents the seriousness of a defendant's criminal history?
Your Honor, that argument was raised by Mr. Bonds' argument that, unlike ordinary offenders, he was not sentenced as a career offender. He was complaining about the fact that the District Court essentially found the predicate for that reduction, which is for essentially the same reason, but he didn't get the full measure or any of the reduction that's warranted the departure on that basis. So while he didn't precisely cite that particular section, that was the substance of that particular aspect of his argument. So the first error, as I said, is undisputed, that Welton is no longer good law for the proposition that Kimbrough can't be applied to the career offender guidelines in cases of where the disparity between crack and powder cocaine is raised. U.S. v. Corner, this court reversed Welton and has confirmed in both Corner and since in the U.S. v. Newbern case that Kimbrough permits offenders to raise policy-based arguments without exception against the career offender enhancement. Again, this error is undisputed. That was the sole basis for the District Court's decision, essential rejection of all of Mr. Bonds' arguments out of hand on the question of objective deficiency of counsel's performance. The second error is that the District Court applied the wrong prejudice standard. The District Court held that no prejudice can exist because Mr. Bonds received a slightly below-guideline sentence that this Court found reasonable on direct appeal. But the standard under Strickland for ineffective assistance of counsel is different. The court must determine instead whether a reasonable probability exists that the outcome would have been different absent the error. The court gave no consideration to the question of whether, had these arguments been raised, there's a reasonable probability of success.
I guess the bottom line, though, is how can we hold that it was ineffective in 2007 to fail to raise an argument that had no precedential support and was rejected by our court in 2008?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that there was precedential support in Kimbrough, and that was released only a week before Mr. Bonds was sentenced, and his attorney certainly should have been aware of it. This court recently in the Newbern case recognized that Kimbrough opened the door to the very sorts of policy arguments that Mr. Bonds is making here. This court did later hold, subsequent to his sentencing, that a subset of those arguments attacking the career offender guidelines range specifically where they're based on the disparity, a disparate ratio in the treatment of crack and powder cocaine, that those arguments couldn't be challenged, and then in Corner reversed course and said that without exception, any basis for a policy argument against the career offender guidelines may be raised. But at the time Mr. Bonds was sentenced, there was a recent decision in Kimbrough, and although Kimbrough specifically dealt with the disparate treatment of crack and powder cocaine, the decision forcefully stands for the proposition that that policy arguments can be raised against the guidelines, that in particular policy arguments based on considerations where of the commission where the commission based its sentencing ranges on congressional statutes rather than its own empirical data and national expertise, that in those cases there's it's particularly clear that, that such an argument can be raised against the guidelines. And just like the crack and powder ratios, the career offender guidelines fit that bill, as the Sentencing Commission itself recognized in 2004 when it grouped both of those together as the two strongest bases under which offenders receive disproportionately harsh sentences. So the errors by the district court alone warrant reversal and remand, and the dispute between the parties, between the government and Mr. Bonds, essentially amounts to the government's argument for an alternative basis for affirmance, namely that Mr. Bonds's the representation of Mr. Bonds as a whole was reasonably proficient. But that is not the case. That argument should be rejected because Mr. Bonds's counsel went not only provided an anemic offense. Mr. Bonds's counsel didn't raise the strongest basis for a legal basis for a substantial reduction in his sentence. Mr. Bonds' counsel highlighted some of the facts from the pre-sentence report that certainly went in Mr. Bonds' favor, but never altered the district court's framework from departing from a guideline range of 188 to 235 months to rejecting the career offender enhancement altogether and sentencing him in line with offenders who, based on the base level offense range, receive much smaller sentence. First, as I said, Kimbrough provides a strong basis for making that argument, that policy argument in this case, and it. Mr. Bonds could not be more of a prototypical offender for whom such an argument is likely to succeed. He's serving a 13.5-year sentence despite only being convicted of selling 1.1 grams of crack cocaine, $150 in value and about the weight of a paperclip. His prior offense was for selling 2.6 grams, and the third qualifying offense for the career offender enhancement was nearly 10 years old. And there really were no other factors mentioned by the district court in its at sentencing that would support a greater sentence. The district court simply felt that the guidelines range under which he was subject was the best measure of how comparable offenders are sentenced, when in fact offenders around the country are routinely raise arguments challenging the career offender guidelines on a policy basis and arguing for departure under Section 4A1.3 and accordingly received much less time than Mr. Bonds received, even with much greater amounts of drugs, because those arguments are raised.
I'm puzzled by the same thing that concerned Judge Rovner. Had this argument been made at the time, it would have been rejected. It wouldn't have been a good argument until about 3 years later when we overruled cases like Welton in Corner. So how can one condemn a lawyer as ineffective for not making an argument that was doomed?
Well, Your Honor, I disagree that it was doomed. I would submit that it had a reasonable probability of success and even a great probability of success in this case. The Welton line...
Probability of success, several district judges accepted arguments of that sort around that time, and we reversed them.
Well, the arguments that were at issue in Welton that subsequently became the overruled in Corner were arguments that attack the career offender guidelines simply where they reflect the disparate treatment of crack and powder cocaine. That is, where an offender who, for example, is sentenced for 6 grams of crack falls within a higher sentencing range than one sentenced for 6 grams of powder cocaine. But the question of whether an offender could have challenged the career offender guidelines for policy reasons, namely that they fail for low-level drug offenders, regardless of the type of drug, that they fail to...
The decisions of like Welton, and Welton had been presaged by many other cases in this circuit, said that the career offender guideline was to be treated as a statute because the commission was required to require district judges to sentence at the top of the range for career offenders. That's the rationale of Wellen. It applies to all sorts of arguments for departure from the career offender guideline. Now, we held later in Corner that Wellen and similar cases were wrong. But just saying this lawyer might have made a slightly different argument than the one in Wellen itself doesn't cope with the rationale of Wellen. It was a doomed argument.
Well, Your Honor, I'd point the Court to the U.S. v. Newbern decision, where this Court said that the Wellen line of authority only applied to the ratios for crack and powder cocaine, that every other argument, including that offenders are sentenced far more harshly than they should be under the career offender guidelines, were available. Kimbrough opened that door from the beginning. So the Newbern decision, I think, rejected that argument and said that this was something that could have been raised and should have been raised immediately after Kimbrough. And I think that a district court would certainly be open to that argument. In fact, I see that my time is up.
No, I'm sorry. Finish your thought. I didn't mean to make that noise.
Oh, no. In sum, Mr. Bonds is serving a massive sentence for a very minute amount of drugs, and I think the record reflects that his attorney's failure to cite any legal grounds, or much less even request a reduction, is the reason why he received such a large sentence. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Wyman. Mr. Cox.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Richard Cox on behalf of the United States. If I could, I'd like to begin and follow up with one of the questions that Judge Rovner posed, which is concerns the waiver issue that we've raised. There's no way, shape, or form that Mr. Bonds raised an argument that the career offender guideline, that the criminal history calculation seriously overrepresented his actual criminal history. He did not raise that. He raised a specific claim that the judge had considered something improper under the 3553A factors, which he does not pursue on appeal, and he raised the Kimbrough issue. So with regard to this 4A1.3 argument, that was never presented to Judge Scott. Judge Scott never had an opportunity to consider whether or not it was ineffective counsel not to have raised an argument that was not presented at the time to her, obviously, or whether there was any prejudicial impact. And so, of course, this Court can't do so either. We likewise make it the same argument with regard to the Kimbrough. Mr. Bonds' Kimbrough argument is only is limited to the disparity between the 100-to-1 ratio between treatment of crack cocaine to powder cocaine. And in this case, which of course is what Kimbrough was primarily dealt with, and that was not at issue in this case because 1.1 grams of powder cocaine or 1.1 grams of crack cocaine would have resulted in the same career offender guideline for Mr. Bonds in this case because there was no mandatory minimum. The statutory maximum for each of those offenses was 30 years. So consequently, he was a career offender, whether it was powder cocaine or crack cocaine, and he was subject to a advisory guidelines range of 188 to 235 months. So those were his claims in the district court. Now, they've been expanded a bit here on appeal, and now Mr. Bond's counsel is making an argument that somehow his counsel was deficient in not making a more policy-based attack on the career offender guidelines. But we have to remember that he was making his sentencing argument in December of 2007, only shortly after Kimbrough was decided, and Kimbrough was not a career offender case. It was a calculation of drug weights under Section 2D1.1 under the guidelines. It was, I submit, it was unclear at that time whether it applied to career offenders. And this Court's later jurisprudence, I'd say over the next several years, indicated that there was indeed a lot of, I won't call it confusion, but certainly the questions as to what application Kimbrough had with regard to career offenders. So to hold counsel now subject to an argument that this Court didn't resolve until 2010, that he should have somehow come up with that same argument in 1 week after Kimbrough in 2007 would seem to me to be not possibly amount to constitutionally deficient performance. And if the panel has no further questions, then I would...
Of course, it is clear that there were other attorneys at the time who recognized that the sentencing challenge could be raised in that we decided the issue not long after Kimbrough, you know, with Harris.
You're right, Judge Rovner, and Mr. Wyman was also correct. There's certainly language in the Kimbrough opinion that later becomes supportive of this idea that you can, or the concept that you can have a disagreement with the policy behind the guideline itself. And
it's not a crazy idea.
No, I didn't mean to say it was crazy.
No, I didn't.
Just that
you didn't.
And I guess I'd also like to say that Mr. Bonds' attorney at the time actually began his remarks at sentencing by saying to Judge Scott, I recognize that you do not have to sentence Mr. Bonds within the guideline range calculated by the criminal history calculation. And Judge Scott agrees. And, in fact, she doesn't sentence him within. In fact, she goes lower than the government's recommendation after the 5K1 and sentences him below that. So she clearly recognizes she wasn't bound to follow and sentence Mr. Bonds purely and statistically, I guess, or based on the just pure calculations as a career offender. So if there are any further questions, then I would yield the balance of my time.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Wyman. And again, thanks to Mayor Brown for taking the appointment in this case, and we appreciate your assistance to both the court and your client. The case is taken under advisement.